Okay, folks, we'll get started with our next presentation, which is GE, and John Rice, who I think this is your third year of joining us, right, John? Maybe it's fourth, but John, I think it's third. John is Vice Chairman, President, and CEO of GE's Technology Infrastructure segment, and I think most of you know Trevor Schoenberg, who heads up the investor relations effort at GE also. So I think there's a couple of things we want to accomplish today, and we'll use our typical Q&A format. But I think the audience can be very curious to know if GE is, in fact, at a bit of an inflection point. I don't know if I want to say we're out of the woods as far as the lion's share of macro problems, but it does seem like a lot of the challenges that you and your peers have gone through in the last couple of years are more in the rearview mirror than in front of you. So I would like to spend some time on GE specific and what GE is doing to prepare itself for the next upcycle, if you will, whether it's slow or normal, we'll see. But preparation, then obviously, I think the audience would be curious to see what you're seeing out there in the world today, given the cross current of macro indicators that we're getting and conflicting data in general. What we've heard in the last couple of days is what I'll call kind of micro-optimism and macro confusion. And that being that companies with either whether it's a short order cycle book or long cycle order book are seeing relatively good orders and no real sign of slowdown, yet pretty much every management team will be the first to admit that there's some cautiousness out there that has accelerated over the last few weeks that concerns them, but yet they're not seeing it in their order books, they're not seeing it in their activity. So GE, being such a large global company, oftentimes can have a better read of what's out there. And I think in your particular businesses, John, that you're responsible with, I think you're sitting kind of on the front row of what's out there. So maybe we can start a little bit with a state of the union, if you can update us on what you're seeing out there, and then we can move into more specific questions.
Sure. Well, I like your macro confusion, micro optimism. I think that resonates with me. From a macro perspective, we worry about the same things that you all worry about. Higher unemployment rates than we'd like to see, not all the availability of capital for people who need to expand or add inventory or borrow. And there's debate between the banks who say it is and the borrowers who say it isn't, but in general, doesn't appear to be flowing the way it should. Caution that comes from having been through the worst recession in our business career. So I think people are naturally a little restrained in terms of how they think about the future. So there is a little bit of macro confusion in the U.S. How does financial service reform play through? How does healthcare reform play through? You're going to start seeing some of the pieces to that over the next 6 to 9 to 12 months. And what kind of an impact does it have? On the micro side, most of what we're looking at is reasonably positive. If you think about the aviation business, whether passenger or freight, the volume is up again in July. Healthcare orders are up in total, still significant double-digit growth in the emerging markets, and pockets of growth in the developed markets, obviously not a lot in the U.S. and Western Europe, but it's certainly not a disaster. It's okay. Rail car loadings up, half the units in storage now than were in storage at the end of the year. So, some of the pieces that you look at the individual business level continue to be pretty positive, but exercising caution from a macro perspective is kind of what it's all about for us. So we still feel pretty good about the businesses, but trying to sort through the macro, which of the macro indicators really come home to roost.
John, one of the things, GE has been in a rather defensive position, I'd say, over the last couple of years. You've unfortunately forced to cut your dividend and build back up capital on the balance sheet. And GE, over the course of many years prior to that, was really in an offensive position and really out there making more aggressive investments and such. Are you at the turn again of moving more offensively again?
Yeah.
And can you give us some examples, I guess?
Well, I think what we did with the dividend and the buyback, you know, 30 days ago is Exhibit A.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the way we worked through the last couple of years, look, not everything went exactly the way we thought it would, but we generally performed better from a financial service perspective than most people thought we would. Most pieces of our portfolio outperformed expectations, so we feel pretty good about that. We feel really good about our ability to generate cash, and we laid some pretty big numbers out, for 2009, at the end of 2008. There were a lot of skeptics, and we did what we said we would do and more. So from a cash perspective, and still feel bullish about our ability to generate cash from working capital. So the kind of things that matter in a world where predicting the future is hard, we think we're delivering on, and that, you know, honestly, the ability to generate that cash and continue generating it clearly gives us the opportunity to start working the dividend back to what we'd like it to be, and gives us dry powder for the right kind of acquisitions. And we're spending a lot of time thinking about those. We're not going to run out and buy stuff just for the sake of buying it. We're going to be thoughtful. The other piece I'd add to that is over the course of this recession, Scott, we maintained or increased our R&D spending in our businesses, and in the aggregate, increased it. And this year, it's going to be up 20%. And I think that's something that kind of gets lost in the swirl of all this. It's the easiest number to cut when times are tough. In long cycle, high technology businesses, you do that at your peril. And it wouldn't be me that you'd be flogging 10 years from now because I'd be on the beach. But, you know, it would be somebody else because we wouldn't have the engine, the engine on the right airframe, or there'd be something else that was missing. And so I feel really good about that. We're going to introduce 160 new products in our healthcare business between 2009 and 2010, and kind of keep that pace up for the next few years, and that's because we're investing.
On the topic of R&D, John, because I do think that's something, and again, whether this is fair or not fair, I think historically GE is characterized as being, you know, marketing heavy and product light. And if you take a look, flash forward now, it really made some strides on the product side, and if anything, maybe more product heavy and marketing light now, if you wanted to be critical. When you think about focusing those projects and with a company as large as GE, and particularly when you think about the big businesses that you've historically been responsible for, power gen in a prior life, aviation, and the rest of the technology infrastructure segment now, I mean, how do you maintain focus, enough focus to make a difference and move the needle? Because it's changed. I mean, just to back up a little bit, I think of GE as having kind of historically had one technology center in Schenectady, New York. It was fairly run down, not that impressive. Now it's double the size. It's very nice. It's been modernized. And then you added China. You put a fantastic facility in Germany. I think you even have some satellite facilities in
Bangalore.
Bangalore, even Russia, right? So you have something there?
We've got them in a lot of places. The global corporate research are in four.
The big stuff.
And then one coming in Brazil.
Brazil.
So Brazil will be the fifth.
So that's a sea change. But how do you manage that spend to maximize productivity and make sure that you're putting out products that are timely and relevant?
Yep. Well, it's we talked a little bit about this in one of the small group meetings. It's really both art and science. We had a 2-hour review with Jeff last week on the GENX program. So here's a CEO of an enormous company spending 2 hours to go line by line, part by part through the GEnx engine program to make sure that we're and to gauge the team. This was the aviation team in face to face and gauge whether we're equipped to do what we say we're going to do for Boeing and the airlines. And so there's a piece of the just good old-fashioned management attention, because you have to gauge the ability of your teams to do what they say they're going to do. And that's both today and yesterday and tomorrow. When they say, "We got to do it, and it's going to cost $50 million," at some point, you have to believe them in order to approve it, right? And so part of this is the artwork that goes behind gauging the caliber of the people who are in front of you and their ability to do what they say they're going to do. And then you develop other points of input. We spend a lot of time talking to the airframers. Jeff and I, whether it's Tom Enders or Jim McNerney or his team, to get our own sense for what they're thinking about re-engineering. And then when David Joyce and the team come in and say, "Hey, this is the way we're thinking about re-engineering," we have our own data points, and then we use third parties to cross-collaborate. And then you've got to have a series of metrics and performance objectives tied to very specific day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month. The real challenge is you take a 10-year program and break it up and run it like you run a manufacturing facility where every week you know what you have to have accomplished, right? And so that you do all of that.
In that spirit, let's talk a little bit about aviation. There's a lot of aerospace and defense companies at this conference this week, and the engine business has changed fairly dramatically. You have the re-engineering, as you talked about, which seems to be throwing a bit of a loop in plans. You have a number of R&D programs that you're going to have to fund all at once. The economics of the entire engine industry appear to be have gotten less interesting, at least over the last couple of years, because you put a tremendous amount of upfront investment, and then the payback is way back, yet the older airplanes are no longer in demand anymore. And so the economics of the razor blade is it just seems to be a little bit out of whack. I mean, how do you think about those changes in the industry and its relative attractiveness now? And how do you change GE to change with kind of the reality that there's more airplane makers out there, there's more engine programs you need to be funding, and obviously an impact on margins as a result?
Yeah. That's a good point. No question, when we look at the next 3-5 years, we're looking at increases in program funding requirements just because of the number of engine programs. I mean, you got to finish the GEnx, the 747-8, what Boeing does with the 777, the re-engine versus new airframe on the single aisle that Airbus and Boeing are going through. So the sum total of all that is you got a lot more going on over the next 3-5 years than you really ever had in the decade of the '90s when it was really just about the GE90, 777, right? And so we've mapped that and modeled the next couple of years, assuming that it all has to get done. And so we because we're not going to put ourselves in a position of not being on the airframes that we want to be on. Others have made that call in the last 20 years, and it's when you're out, you're out. And we are convinced that we can execute and that we can pick the right programs. As far as the underpinnings of the business and your point about the basic way the service and aftermarket stuff works, fortunately, the older planes or the older razors, to your example, don't have our blades on them. So that's not necessarily a bad thing from our perspective. And we look at an installed base. There's around 19,000 aircraft flying in the world. About 62% have a GE or a CFM engine on them, and only 40% of those engines have hit their first maintenance cycle. So there's a lot of wind at our back over the next 3 to 5 years. Now, which quarter, how this maps out in terms of quarters, that's reasonably difficult to predict, but there's a lot of goodness, yet to come. The other thing that we are doing to augment that basic service business is all the stuff that we're investing in on intelligent engine and knowledge-based systems and the avionics packages. You read last week about the American Airlines flight that used some of our technology. So there's frankly a lot more coming that will create a service business in the future that is different than the one we have today.
I'll ask another question. We'll start, and then we'll queue up for audience questions. Again, not to harp on aerospace, but boy, I've never seen GE get so aggressive in avionics as you've seen over the last several months. And the question I get from investors all the time is, does GE have the product? Do they have the breadth of product to compete against these great traditional guys like the Rockwell Collins and the Honeywells of the world that have phenomenal installed base in avionics and a great history? You've won some very key programs in China, which is critical. But I still get the question of, do you have the product and the capability and the expertise to really deliver and continue to move forward without having to go out and buy some technology?
We have pieces of expertise that's as good or better than what the other guys have. We don't have the girth, and we haven't had the girth. We're number four when we bought the Smiths business. We're number four behind Honeywell and Rockwell Collins and Thales, and we knew that. And we looked at opportunities and ways that we could move up the food chain because part of this is capability and part of it's just capacity, right? As airframers think more about wanting, top-tier integration, you gotta be big and good. You can't just be good. You gotta be big and good to do that. And so the thing with AVIC is what we concluded was our best move to create the capabilities which would give your investors a good answer to their question.
Right.
So the way I'd say it today is we do have a lot of discrete capabilities. That's why AVIC wants to partner with us, because we do bring a lot to the table. What we don't bring is size. And the combination of us and AVIC creates capability and size. We have a platform to launch it on, the COMAC C919, that will fly in the 2014, 2015 timeframe, and a domestic market in China that will need somewhere around 200 planes a year, and that becomes the beachhead on which we grow. So fair question, and we think we've got a strategy that's right in the crosshairs.
Okay. Let's open it up to the audience, please. And
there's one over here.
Oh, we have a question right here.
Going back to the macro versus the micro confusion, and I'm trying to reconcile the two, and the pockets of growth, be it emerging markets, be it some pockets of developed Europe and U.S., I think has overwhelmed the negative pockets till now. So we are still seeing good growth. So my question is, going ahead, whatever we are negative we are seeing in the macro, or that part of the world which is flat to negative, what's the chance of that overwhelming the positive part over the next 12 months? Is it more than a 50% chance? Because I understand till now it has not shown, mainly because of, pretty solid growth in different parts of the world, so.
I think it's less than 50%. I mean, when I go to, say, China, which, there's is there a little housing bubble in China? Is the growth going to be something less than 10%? It's possible, but it's still going to be growth. It's still going to be healthy growth. And then I look at the micro, and I ask the senior leaders I'm with, business or government, what's important to you? And they talk about, now they always say two things: healthcare and environment. And those kind of play to our strengths. So I really see emerging markets continuing to need the infrastructure investments that we and others can facilitate. And I don't see that changing. I look at healthcare, the The way we measure it, the size of the healthcare industry in the U.S. is some $40 billion-ish. India is $1 billion. Latin America is $2 billion. China is $4 billion. I mean, I don't know how much bigger the U.S. market needs to get. You know, it'd be nice if it grew, but $40 billion is a pretty healthy number. But how long do you think India is going to spend $1 a person on healthcare? You know, there's just enormous. Now it might not be $50 a person anytime soon, but could it be $10? Yeah. Is China going to spend $3 a person forever? No. They know. The Chinese government knows that they have to get better healthcare and better access to the 800 or 900 million people that don't live in tier one cities. And that's going to happen. Now, is it going to happen in the third quarter of 2012? You know, I don't really know that, but this is a long-term bet, and it is going to happen. And I quarter to quarter, who knows? Long-term, stay the course.
Question here? Go ahead, sir.
I was just wondering if you could discuss the trends that you're seeing in power generation, I guess in terms of orders, maybe within the developed markets and then emerging markets.
Well, you know, orders in the developed markets are going to be soft for a while for the big stuff. I think the little stuff will continue. There's going to be pockets of inefficiencies that, you know, air derivative, the, you know, small reciprocating, wind, you know, wind in some places in the U.S., maybe if we get energy, a decent energy policy. So the big stuff, not a lot in the developed markets, but you will see it in the developing markets. The small stuff, selectively in both markets.
Next question. Right here. Either one is fine.
I just wanted to ask a bit on hiring trends. What are you thinking in your own businesses, and then what would you need to see, you know, on the macro side to, you know, get more comfortable with hiring?
You know, there isn't. We take this even down to the product line level. I mean, we don't have a macro hiring strategy because, you know, you take our healthcare business where we did some restructuring over the last couple of years like we did in virtually all of our businesses, but it was more about repositioning cost and taking employment away from areas weren't growing and putting it in areas that were. But in the U.S., for example, in our healthcare IT business, we never stopped adding people because we saw what was happening with the legislation. We knew we needed to do the work, and so you can't even make one definitive comment about healthcare, let alone GE or all of the technology infrastructure businesses, because there are markets where we have specific needs that we're going to add people. We're adding 1,300 people in Michigan to do software and advanced manufacturing work, and it's one of the best decisions we've made. I mean, we are getting displaced, most of them displaced from the automotive industry, talented people who are hitting the ground running, and the cost differential, you know, what we're seeing, and this is a little bit of an aside, but it might be interesting, is that even the cost differential is trumped by competence, right? If you have access to good people, you will put them wherever that access point is, regardless of what you have to pay them. You know, chasing a lower labor cost is a short-term strategy. And you see that now with some of the Indian, you know, the offshore, you know, Wipro and Tata putting facilities in the United States. Right? Wipro has one in Atlanta. Tata, they have several. Tata has several. I mean, it's obviously more expensive to do that, but competence trumps cost. And that's what we're seeing in Michigan. But in terms of overall employment, we do not want our business leaders to kind of butter spread, you know, because it's never that simple. Each product line, each strategy has to have a plan, and if that results in more employment, that's what it results in.
Question right here. Go ahead.
I hate to belabor the point, but it's an important one. It sounds like you're running GE as if you think the economy is going to continue to grow, particularly in the emerging markets, but the developed markets as well. You're hiring, you're increasing R&D. I think CapEx is going up as well, presumably adding capacity where needed. Is that a fair assessment? And could you talk more specifically, as best you can, about whether GE Capital is operating under the same set of assumptions, lending more, making more credit available, sort of taking advantage of the tight credit conditions that we hear about?
Sure. I think your assessment for the company is pretty accurate. We're also cautious about the macro economy, so we're not doing anything that we think will look stupid if we don't see the growth rates that we expect. But yeah, you have to play offense. And in the last 18 months, there were a lot of companies, including ours, where you could argue we weren't playing too much offense. Although I could say getting through a recession, increasing R&D, and doing a pretty good job in financial services is playing offense. But the point is, I think your point is right. From a capital perspective, we'll continue to shrink the portfolio, so we won't change that strategy. Exactly which pieces get smaller and what it looks like in 12 to 18 months, we're going to let the markets determine what that should be. If a capital business can get good pricing, maybe we let that become a little bit bigger. So the market will determine the relative size of the pieces. We're going to bring that down.
Next question. Couple in the back.
Thanks. Can you talk a little bit about the nuclear market and your competitive positioning and see how you see that evolving over the next 5 or 10 years?
We think we have a pretty smart position in nuclear because, the nuclear business is never going to be a business that moves the GE needle, but it's a good business. It's a profitable business. It's got a small but a wonderful return on capital, because we've co-invested with the government over years to develop the technology. BWR technology, boiling water reactor technology, which is what we have, is very good technology. We're going to be very selective about how we pursue it, and we are not going to chase crazy deals. And if you do the history on the plant that's being built by Areva in Finland, we dropped out of that bidding over the last $50 million in, I think, 2004 or 2005. And Areva will lose $2 billion or $3 billion on that project. For exactly the reasons that we dropped out. The specs hadn't been defined. The Finnish regulatory agency was still not clear about what they were going to record. There were all the kind of things that cause you to say, "Nope, I ain't going there." And that's exactly, as investors, what you want us to do. We think we can play an effective game in nuclear at a small scale, and we're going to do that. We're not going to let that business get bigger than it needs to be, and we're not going to chase bad deals. And we're not going to do business in countries where the nuclear liability regime is not well-defined. There's no need for us to do that. There's no need for us to do that.
Next question. So another one back here. Maybe we can go back to aerospace a little bit and focus on the defense side. And you made a comment earlier that it was interesting. When you're out, you're out, and you run a risk of being potentially out of the defense business if the Joint Strike Fighter dual engine program doesn't get approved by Congress. What is plan B? Maybe you can walk us through plan A and plan B.
Yeah.
Plan A, you're in it. Plan B, you're not in it. What do you do to make sure that you don't get completely shut out of the defense business?
Yeah, I was going to say plan A and plan B are to win. First of all, that will play out over a decade or two, right? So, the the medium to even longish term impact is minimal. There's still going to be a lot of F-16s, a lot of F-18s flying for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons we're fighting as hard as we're fighting on that is because we're right. You know, when you look at the merits of this, and I was saying to a smaller group, you know, we are in Washington, and all, you know, just about every regulation that comes out of Washington has some impact on us, you know, financial service reform, healthcare, and all that stuff. And there's not been one issue in my 32 years in GE that we have felt stronger about, that we have spent more time with the board on so that they understand that we are going to take this one as far as it needs to go. Because this is what you want with procurement reform. Defense budgets shouldn't go up 5 to 10% a year. We have to get smarter about how we spend this money. And if you ask 100 people what you mean by procurement reform, they'll say lots of different things, but they'll include two things in every discussion. One is competition, and the second is fixed pricing. Right? And that's what we've laid right out on the table, and it's quite an interesting process. So we are right. If we don't win, we've got a couple of different options that will play out over the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, who knows? Maybe we don't win, and they'll realize at some point in a year or two the error of their ways, and we can get started again. There's a lot of support for what we want to do. There's one guy in the Defense Department that doesn't support it.
Yes, one guy.
One guy.
He has to be the most important guy.
He's a pretty important guy. And a guy, by the way, we have a lot of respect for. Okay? We disagree completely on this issue. But in general, what he's trying to do with the Defense Department, I give him a lot of credit for doing. But I think he's totally wrong on this.
Take a question back here.
Yeah, hi. A topic that's come up recently is, you know, capital allocation with GE. And can you just let us maybe look into what you guys are thinking in, from a senior management level on allocation of capital? I mean,
sure.
You've mentioned previously that you're looking at deals, and possibly there could be some, you know, accretive deals out there that you guys look to capitalize on.
Sure.
There's also your shrinking GE capital. And you're generating cash. So what about increasing and being more aggressive on shrinking the flow to the company? Is that something you're looking at, or is it continuing to decrease or shrink GE capital and then grow industrial, or can you do both? And when I say buying back stock or shrinking the float, I'm talking about something meaningful and you know, actually taking the share count down versus just offsetting.
Yep.
Stuff.
Well, it's a great question, and we, in fact, in July, we do a growth playbook, kind of a 3 to 5 to 10 year look, if you think about the aviation business. Every year, we have a cycle that starts in really March or April, and culminates in a day and a half discussion with the board in July, where we lay out our view of the next 3 to 10 years. And as part of that, we put together a couple of different capital allocation scenarios for them that touch on just the points that you make. You know, what kind of cash will we generate from our businesses? What will we think about in terms of the dividend? And it was the board meeting where we decided to, you know, to increase the dividend and do the buyback that we announced. What are the M&A opportunities? You know, and you got to kind of look at it over a 3-year time frame, because sometimes it takes that long to gestate these opportunities. We don't do hostile deals, so we have to work the system to generate interest in selling something to us if a company's not already for sale. But with the way we think about it, we could, you know, to continue working on the dividend, follow through on the buyback that we announced, do the internal P&E investment that we need, and have $30 billion-ish available for for acquisitions over the next 2 or 3 years. Now, that doesn't mean that we'll spend that money. It doesn't mean that we won't do more with the dividend or with the buyback or decide that, you know, we if we were to conclude that there aren't the deals out there that make sense, we might do less than that. You know, we're not going to chase bad deals just so that we can say we spent X billion on M&A. So we sit as a group. Jeff and the vice chairman have a regular dialogue. You know, we have a board meeting on Friday. We'll talk about it again. Here's the follow-up to that discussion. So the board is intimately involved in this, knows the deals that are in the pipeline that represent some of the ways that we might want to allocate that capital and the trade-offs that we're making. You know, I'd say the M&A pipeline is the biggest variable because you don't always know who's going to be for sale when or whether you can do a deal at a price that makes sense for both sets of shareholders, right? And in the end, that's what you got to do. So we go through it monthly, the pipeline, the deal pipeline. Just did it last Friday. We look at, you know, 20 or 30 different companies and debate and discuss, and that's how it works. It's a very iterative process, I think, with a lot of discipline.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you, John, for your time. Thank you, Trevor. Thank you for your questions, everybody.
Great. Thanks.